proceed to the sixth case. United States v. Hudson. Mr. Stevens.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Jay Stevens, and I represented Mr. Hudson at the trial level on this case. This is a sentencing guideline case, and it involves legal interpretation of a sentencing guideline, and so accordingly the review in this case is de novo. Mr. Machacek and I were talking about this case yesterday and sort of facetiously looked at each other and said, well, this court can probably just read Crittenden and you'll have arguments, because two of the judges sided with Mr. Machacek's position in that case, and one, the dissent, Judge Dennis, sided with mine. But I think there's still quite a bit left to talk about in this case. And I want to talk about, first, the Sentencing Commission was looking for uniformity in sentencing guidelines. And so it's clear from the structure of the sentencing guidelines as well as the case law that's developed that it doesn't make any difference whether you're dealing with a federal or state law. It's the conduct that is involved. Having said that...
Can I just say to you, Mr. Stevens, I mean, I think the argument that you're raising is actually a very interesting one, but, and here's my, I have two issues with it. One of them is that if we were to accept your position, there would be a rather glaring gap in the federal sentencing guidelines when federal law is the reference, not something like Indiana law that covers all of these different areas. And four courts of appeals at this point are against you, so you'd be asking us to strike out and create this odd gap when we could avoid it simply by understanding the word counterfeit in a somewhat broader way than maybe its literal meaning is for other parts of the guidelines.
Well, let me address your question then in just a couple of ways. First, if we're looking for uniformity in sentencing, not all states have look-alike statutes. There is no federal statute involving look-alike substances, only counterfeit substances. So the behavior that if the decisions of the four courts of appeal that have decided this the other way, what they've said is conduct that's illegal in some states but not all states, conduct that's illegal in some states but not under federal law, affects the sentencing guidelines, and that doesn't lead to uniformity of sentencing.
It doesn't, but it's certainly not unique in the guidelines where the incorporation of state law means that there's a certain lack of uniformity. You know, prior commission of a felony, well, you know, states vary a bit in what they define as a felony. Some things are felonies in one state and misdemeanors in other states. So whenever you look at state law, you're going to see a certain lack of horizontal uniformity. Maybe it means that everybody in that one state is treated the same way. So I don't disagree with you that there would be some lack of uniformity, but I guess it's at a policy level that I'm concerned about taking such a such a business definition of the word counterfeit. I mean, it's not like you're walking down Fifth Avenue and somebody's trying to sell you a Rolex watch. I mean, we all understand that's a particular use of the word counterfeit. But here, you know, if the guy had bags of oregano and he was trying to pass it off as marijuana, maybe that's behavior, as the other courts have said, that's also dangerous.
Well, I think what the courts have said is, number one, let's look at the dictionary definition, and number two, let's look at the fact that this same conduct creates an aura of violence similar to what you would have in a drug deal. But it's important to notice that the Sentencing Commission has not prohibited all conduct that carries an air of violence in connection with what might involve a drug deal. For instance, you see a drug deal in the process. A guy you know as a drug dealer goes into a house carrying drugs. You break into his car, hoping you're going to find money. Well, if he catches you, there's going to be violence. But Congress has not said, and the Sentencing Commission has not said, that merely the presence of violence creates an aggravator for guideline purposes. They have not said that a crime in connection with a drug trafficking offense. They've said a crime that is a controlled substance offense. And so they could have broadened that definition by saying in connection with. But instead, they said is a controlled substance offense. And 841A defines a controlled substance offense as either, for our purposes at least, dealing in a controlled substance or dealing in a counterfeit substance, both of which are covered by the guidelines. So I think the plain language refers back to 841A. And that's, I think that's a strong reason to believe that that's what the Sentencing Commission meant, notwithstanding what the four courts of appeal have said. So the danger issue could be covered by saying in connection with. But there are other dangerous situations surrounding a drug deal that are not covered by the guidelines, that are not aggravators. So I don't think we can tie it specifically to that.
Mr. Stevens, I think I understand the logic of your argument based on the tracing the language from the guidelines through the relevant statutes. I'm trying to understand why the Sentencing Commission would have drawn the distinction that you believe it did.
Well, I don't know why the Sentencing Commission would draw that distinction other than 841A describes two conducts, both counterfeit and controlled substances, and so they've incorporated both of those in the guidelines. That may be one reason that they put both of them in there, is because 841 references both scheduled substances and counterfeit substances. Now, with regard to the dictionary definition, one dictionary definition of counterfeit certainly is a copy. But the common, ordinary understanding of the word counterfeit doesn't necessarily mean copy. My wife might be stopped by a vendor on the streets of Chicago, and he's got a red bag that looks just like the Louis Vuitton bag that she saw in the store next door for $1,000, and he's selling it for $49.95. She knows that's a copy. It looks just like it. It's a look-alike substance, but it's not a counterfeit, and she doesn't say that's a counterfeit. She says that's a copy. Now, maybe she might call it a counterfeit because it's on the streets of Chicago, but if she goes into Kohl's and sees that same bag and it doesn't have the Louis Vuitton emblem on it like the one on the street had, because that was a counterfeit, it had a fake Louis Vuitton sticker on it. The one in the store also is a red bag, same size, same shape. But it's made by a Chinese manufacturer to look alike, and she knows when she looks at that it's a look alike, but it's not in her mind a counterfeit.
But the model that you're using doesn't work well when the underlying substance itself is illegal. It's not like you can go get the High Times trademark for your marijuana.
Not yet. In some states.
In some states, yes, I gather I'm out of date. But at least here in Illinois, that's not available to you. So the whole intellectual structure of trademark law and counterfeits and the rest that applies to legitimate goods doesn't really apply to illegal goods. And instead, doesn't it seem, Congress is defining a whole set of controlled substances, that is to say illegal things, they use the counterfeit. Why shouldn't that just sort of mean phony?
But Congress did indeed define counterfeit substances, and they defined counterfeit substances specifically under the terms of trademark and business property.
But my question is, why do we carry that definition over to the Controlled Substances Act?
Well, I think because obviously Congress intended to prohibit two kinds of substances. They have not as of yet prohibited plain old look-alike substances, even if they look exactly like a bag of white powder that is being represented as cocaine. We had a fellow in our neighborhood, our community, that stole oven doors, and he packaged them up, and he was selling them as flat-screen TVs on the street. Very enterprising. Were they counterfeits? No.
Awesome.
Did people look at them and believe they were buying flat-screen TVs? Yes. And in the ordinary sense of the word, though, they weren't counterfeit.
Turn it off.
I can go over to the Chicago Art Museum here and buy a print on art canvas of a Monet. It looks just like it. An expert, of course, can tell the difference, but when I'm across the room from it, I can't tell the difference. I can take it to some gullible person and represent it to be a Monet and sell it to him for a bargain price of $10,000. It's a look-alike. They think it is the same substance. They don't think of it as counterfeit. The law doesn't think of it as counterfeit because what it is, in fact, is a copy, and I'm committing fraud I'm not committing counterfeiting. And I think that's where the difference is, and that's where the other courts of appeal have failed in their analysis. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer those. Otherwise, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Stevens. Mr. Misajic?
May it please the Court, Mr. Stevens, Your Honors, my name is John Misajic, and I represent the United States. And I'd like to pick up on the issue raised by Judge. Oh, by the way, I'm from Charleston, West Virginia. So if you have any questions about geography, I'll be happy to answer those. In any event, the uniformity issue, I believe that actually cuts in favor of the government's argument, as mentioned by Judge Wilkinson in his opinion in Mills, where he said it really makes no sense for the guideline to pick up in its enhancement the sale of fake pharmaceuticals, but not in the same enhancement pick up the sale of fake narcotics or illegal narcotics. And I think that really, if there's one quote out of all those cases that I could isolate, that to me makes the best sense as far as a policy argument, as far as uniformity is concerned in these cases. The both Mills and Judge and Crittenden, both of those cases, or the majority in Crittenden, talked about the dangers that were involved with the sale of fake narcotics being the same as those when there is actual real narcotics being sold, and that because of that, there's a good policy, very strong policy argument, according to Judge Wilkinson, that to cover or to include in the definition of counterfeit fake narcotics, as Judge Miller did in his decision. Now, I'd also like to point out that Judge Dennis's dissent in Crittenden, that case was decided in 2004. Since that decision and his dissent, the Mills case was decided, or in Robertson, in January of 2007, Mills in June of 2007. And both of those courts had the opportunity to consider what Judge Dennis was saying in his dissent, and they didn't pick up on that. And the Sentencing Commission, it's now been 6 years since that decision, so, and they have not made any effort to address this, Judge Dennis's issue with the definition of counterfeit. So apparently they've found that, I don't know if you can assume this, but there apparently is not a disagreement with how the circuit courts are going in with regard to this issue. Judge Mills also mentioned in Wilkinson that with regard to pulling in the definition of counterfeit from the 841 statute, that the Sentencing Commission knows how to do that, and they did in a different section of the guidelines, 2D1.1, where they did reference that narrower definition of counterfeit, but they didn't do it in these two guideline sections, and so it doesn't make sense. He says the commission knows how to cross-reference. They chose not to do it in this case, and we don't see any reason to do it ourselves. I believe that the bottom line in this case, Your Honor, is that the district court was correct. There are strong policy reasons for a broader interpretation of counterfeit, and it makes no sense, as Mill said, to treat fake pharmaceuticals different from fake narcotics for purposes of uniformity under the guidelines.
Is it correct, Mr. Misajic, that if I go out on the street and offer a kilo of baking powder for $20,000, representing it to be cocaine, that I have committed no federal crime?
Your Honor, I think that is correct, unless the government could cast it in terms of an attempt to commit a narcotics offense. And
if I know it's baking powder,
that's the problem.
I'm surprised to learn that, frankly. But
well, yeah, I was too, Your Honor. And I haven't always been a federal prosecutor, and I was surprised to find that out myself. But Congress, in its infinite wisdom, seems to have left that open. And there is overlap between federal and state narcotics laws, and maybe that just hasn't been something that Congress has seen fit to fill in the gap on.
But you know, I mean, what this raises is something I've been thinking about, which is the difference between the conduct that Congress has chosen to define as an offense, whether it's an offense to do what Judge Hamilton's talking about, on the one hand, and on the other hand, whether certain conduct suggests that a more stringent sentence should be imposed on somebody. So going out and selling the kilo of baking powder might suggest that you're the kind of person, once you're being sentenced for something that was a federal crime, that you're engaging in behavior that could lead to violent or undesirable results. So in other words, the sentencing factor might be a somewhat different point than the offense factor.
Yeah, you're correct, Your Honor. And the guidelines do take into account offenses that are offenses under state law that have no federal counterpart. I guess most,
or even conduct that may or may not be an independent offense, but if you've engaged in a certain kind of conduct, then you seem to be deserving of a more stringent sentence.
Right. I guess one example might be if you are in a position of trust with regard to a victim in a case. That's an enhancement under the guidelines.
Right.
And certainly in just computing criminal history of criminal defendants, can often take into account offenses that aren't federal offenses, I mean, that have no federal counterpart. Your Honor, if the court has no further questions about the case or West Virginia geography, I'll ask that the court affirm the district court and waive the rest of my time. Thank you.
Judge Dennison, his dissent, said that the difference is that in the kind of case we're talking about, the individual does not have any controlled substances. He does not have any either illegal narcotics or substances that are controlled by federal law. It's fraud, pure and simple. There may be a danger element, but it's fraud. And that's why there's a substantive difference between the types of conduct. I think it's clear that when the Sentencing Commission wrote this guideline, they incorporated wholesale the offenses that were under 841. And if 841A had a third section that said we don't deal in lookalike substances either, then that would have been incorporated in the guidelines. And I think those are the substantive differences, and that's why I'm asking this court to step out and take a different direction than the other courts of appeal have. If there are no further questions, I'll waive the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is taken.